This is tape one, side two, Edward Bowles interview, August 20th, 1987. Well, I think, Dr. Bowles, just to kind of go back to Michael's question again, you've outlined the background of your interest in economic issues. Mm-hmm. I think what we'd like to get a sense of is to what extent in your own mind and in discussions within the War Department, there was an interest in sustaining the aircraft industry in the post-war period.
Now, could I hear that question again?
Okay. But you say you've outlined your interests in,
yes,
in the economic issues, mm-hmm, of mm-hmm, war activity.
Yes.
What we're interested in, I think, is understanding the degree to which you or others in the War Department were interested in the problem of how to keep the aircraft industry economically viable in the post-war period.
I believe, as I understand your question, that I have to confess failure . There was . I'm seeking an escape from your question.
Why? Perhaps, can we turn the question around?
When I had my back propped against Arnold, I somehow felt I was achieving something. And all of a sudden, his retirement. I guess I must stay. It demoralized me. In other words, I have to confess to a fault. My following in the Air Force was because my strength lay in Arnold. Going back to MIT for a moment, Professor Jackson, the head of the Department of Electrical Engineering, D.C. Jackson, when I entered MIT in 1920, I don't know why, but he seemed to take a liking to me. And he became my surrogate father in those early days in the department. Later on, if there's time, I'll develop that for you with respect to MIT. Now, when Arnold left, the last exposure to Rand, outside of general spots, two A spots as we called him, he was a very good friend. I had no one to help me. I did not have the imagination or the incentive to go on with respect to the industry and its peacetime relation to the broad problem of air. Aside from a disappointment in the with the Air Force because it went to pieces with Acre coming in, Acre didn't like me. My feeling about Ira Acre is that because of my strength when I was working for Hap Arnold, and my very close relationship with Tui Spots, Ira Acre was pulled out as commander of the Air Forces in Europe. The Air Force was, as I recall it, put under the man who later became the deputy commander of the 20th Air Force, which Arnold had taken over under his wing initially. Acre was deposed and I've had the feeling that what Spots did when he demoted Acre was inspired perhaps by my view of Acre. Now, that, in my judgment, can't be the fact, but I believe that that was Acre's idea. So when he came back from the wars, I believe he came back with the feeling that I had been, behind the scenes, I had been an influence and is losing the command of the 8th Air Force. What I'm leading up to is to give a lame duck explanation of why I didn't have an inspired desire to go ahead and work on the equivalence problems in industry after the war. And it was a collision of conflicts. I was unhappy over my treatment at MIT, Compton and Bush were the people. And so that prompted me to resign. And this carries me back to the unstable things one is prompted to do by his emotions. I had been so successful in the War Department under Stimson and later Arnold, and in effect Marshall, that I got outside of the Medal of Honor, I think I got every top medal. I believe today I'm probably the only one alive with a Distinguished Service Medal from the Army, given only to people in uniform, and I was an imposter going around in ordinary clothing, excepting when I was at the front. I was damn sure I was going to wear the same uniform as the other people. I didn't want to shoot the bastard who had a camera hanging down on a white collar. And I did. I think this is not an answer to your question. It's just an old man trying to reminisce. I think people are impelled to do things sometimes foolish, sometimes not foolish. I went down, vowed that I was going to be one man working for Stimson, and I ended up with 75 or 78 people on every command. And secondly, I was in an unprecedented way direct communication from the commands to my office without anybody interfering. And then I got a recognition from the Crown, because putting it in the vulgar vernacular, if I hadn't been in Washington, we might still be stumbling over defense on the V-1s, the missiles as they began to drop on England. Now, I bring Marshall into it because a British delegation came over to wait on General Marshall, wanting help on the V-1s. Here is a memorandum that my office was on the floor above General Marshall.
For the record, we are referring to a memorandum for Dr. Bowles from General Marshall, is that correct? Dated 21 July 1944. Concerning the use of radar to deter attacks of the V-1 flying weapon.
Now, I treasure this because here's the top dog. Well, this is not directly in your bailiwick. I like it egotistically because it's not a formal piece of paper. I had a meeting in that very afternoon, 14 or 15 people. I like to believe I knew enough about the best of radar to know what was needed for gun laying. I knew proximity fuses, although they hadn't been released, were vital. Bush, by the way, always felt that he had a divine right to suppress the use of guided missiles unless he determined it to be in order. I proceeded and changed the orders to get adequate missiles to supply the British. SCR 584 gun-laying radar, I knew where we had some cached. There was a Lend-Lease man from England in the office, another Lend-Lease man of our own. The Britishers, they were drooling because maybe this materiel would be supplied to them and they would never have to worry about paying us back. I told the two of them, you can just as well leave the meeting. I'm going to consign all this equipment to our U.S. commander, namely General Eisenhower, asking him to make it available to the British as long as he deemed the V-1 emergency to exist. The next day, as I remember the circumstances, we were loading a lot of this material on the ships. I went downstairs to Marshall's office. I found he had left town on an inspection trip. So I helped the Secretary of the General Staff frame an order on General Eisenhower, signed Marshall, to carry out this plan. Marshall came back a week later. I went down to the office, virtually on my hands and knees, and I told him I had to make a confession. I told him what I had done. He said, if you'd done anything else, I would have been disappointed. And I recite that just to give you an idea of my variety of activities. I know I haven't answered your question, but by that time, my mind was in a state of confusion. Do I have some eye drops?
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and pause
it? I want you to...
No. Coming back to Project Rand. Kohlbaum had no idea, I believe, what I had on my mind, the work of the office that was reflected in this whole business. The focus for the moment was really the work on the B-29, which I thought of as over-dramatizing it as a historic step. And this office diary is, in a sense, a valuable thing. It opens with the visit of Douglas, Kindleberger, and Allen. That is the Douglas Company, the North American Company, and Boeing. And I set up a luncheon. I think it's the only time that those three officers, Boeing, North American, and Douglas, were ever brought east at one time to sit down at a meeting. We had a luncheon in officers' mess number one, or a meeting rather, officers' mess number one. And I find that are listed here the various people involved, and it was exaggerating about half the Air Force office in the Pentagon. And there are side comments on Bush's behavior at the meeting, and Kolbaum's getting into a fencing match with Kindleberger. I think Frank making an ass of himself. Now, threaded through here was my effort to get a leader for Project RAND. Douglas, Don Douglas, started a test run of an organization to carry out such a research project. Frank Kolbaum couldn't take it himself because he was preoccupied with Douglas. And as we all know, after the war, Douglas was sliding downhill very fast. And the old man was getting tired, Don Douglas himself. So Kolbaum was sacrificed by Douglas to help out on RAND, while the organization was as yet not set up legally as an independent body. That's my recollection. I tried to get George Dorio to head it. George was top dog at the Harvard Business School, D-O-R-I-O-T. And George was intensely interested. He had done a brilliant job for the Army in the quartermaster's department and broke up a lot of the old taboos to the benefit of the foot soldier. Behind scenes, I guess it's all right to talk about this now. The intelligence people in the Army were bound that Dorio was a spy. And I have behind scenes when, after Stimson left, Patterson came in as Secretary of War. He had wanted me to go on as I had been in the past, kind of a curious emissary out of the office of the Secretary of War. And as in most of these intelligence problems, one finds everybody gets to think that everybody else is a spy. And there was one man, in assistant secretary, I believe, in the Navy, who had it down on George Dorio. Dorio was a conspicuous individual. As I knew his history, there were nine in his family, and he was the only one left after World War I in France. George was a Jew. Never affected his performance. I don't believe he endangered this country. I was given by Judge Patterson a stack of papers that high, FBI other material. Patterson wanted me to go over it. For reasons I don't understand, taking liberties with his charge, he wanted me evidently to help draft a letter for him on what to do. So I was between Scylla and Charybdis, I believe, in mythical form. I did help draft that letter, and it may be hidden in some of the files, things upstairs. I found in the record an FBI man, probably an MIT graduate, a youngster maybe. He'd followed Dorio all the way up to Alaska and all the way back. And in his report to his chief, he regretted that he couldn't find a single thing on Dorio. And to me, it was a marvelous illustration of what happens when you put a youngster on a job and he naturally thinks his responsibility to find the guy is crooked. George was so important to this country that it was hopeful we wouldn't find anything on him. So, to add to that confusion which I faced, Bush behind the scenes was trying to get Dorio to rescue him by taking over the Research and Development Board, which Bush thought would solve all military problems in war and in peace. Dorio was too smart, I think, to get sucked into that. But I then was struggling with Rand, and I found Frank had wonderful forgetful periods. He didn't have Parkinson's, but I would have put that label on him. He could forget completely what he had done. We tried to get a very able physicist, and there are some physicists who are able. Tuve, and Tuve is one of the pioneers in measuring distance by radio, clouds, heights. And two very able man had done made a major contribution to the proximity fuse development. I was unable to get him. He was kind of weary, and I don't wonder. The man who had an affinity for the spectacular was one David Griggs. He happened to be a member of my office. Dave was a lovely character, fresh out of a movie. Should have been in the movies. Alive. And the one thing that interested him was action. And so he spent a good deal of his time in Europe. He was bound to make a trip on a bombing expedition, and like so many of these people who do unusual things, he got aboard a B-17 that was going over to bomb in Germany. How he got in, we don't know. But he didn't take a parachute, because that would have let him know there was somebody aboard. He hid somewhere. Anyway, as fate would have it, he got creased by a German 50 caliber bullet. Ended up in a hospital over in, I don't remember precisely where, it could have been in Italy. And as nature contrives it and things of that sort, he fell heir to a nurse who was a movie actress who had gone in to help the cause. And Dave was excellent when it came to playing a part in the application of radar, of airborne radar, and very important, I think, to me. But the war ended, and Dave didn't have anything to do, and somehow Frank Kohlbaum took him on RAND. This is when it was a seminal organization in the Douglas's hands. And of all people, he was the last one to get into anything like Dave was the last person to get into anything of that sort. And as the records show, Dave left RAND and attached it because he was absolutely out. It was something out of the world for him. He just couldn't fit in. And I tried to introduce into the RAND Douglas organization a man who distinguished himself, a name I've mentioned to you before, Rudolph Winokur. Rudolph was one of the most imaginative people I can imagine. He had been helping originally in OSS and was aboard the submarine when they brought over Carlo Colossi, the Italian who had designed the magnetic detonators for the German torpedoes. And we had frisked him out of Italy when Italy surrendered, and he came over here and was hidden in the Bureau of Ordnance and developed a countermeasure against the German torpedoes for us. And by the way, I finally, after several years, got a memorandum from him that's in the files upstairs on the history of that. And that was of tremendous value to the country. He had been associated all through World War II, first with OSS, as I say, and then somehow advising the War Department. And that's how I ran across him. And he edited most all the papers that I had written. Now, he went out there and gave up in disgust. I had thought that this would put some brains into the organization. And you find in this diary, it starts with the visit of the Douglas Kindleberger Allen, I believe it was, visit, and the meeting, which Dewey Spots handled for me. He did a good job. He believed in the project, that is, Project RAND. And that's when the Kohlbaum got into a tangle with Kindleberger by coming along with one of his tempestuous ideas. Now, I believe you have the name of a man that Douglas surrendered for the project. One of the first people actively working for RAND. And this is very early. I'm trying to think of his name.
Are you thinking of Dick Goldstein?
I think, yes. I think that's it. Now, jumping a bit in Armageddon.
All right, let's pause for now. Let's pull that out.
I've been through that book, marked it up a bit.
All right, do you want to make some comment about it?
Yes.
Okay, for the record, this is Fred Kaplan's book, The Wizards of Armageddon.
Thanks. Here, the opening has quite a bit to say about Arnold and myself. And one place where the writer failed completely to get the message on the V1s. It turns out that after I went on this binge for General Marshall, we were shooting down over 90% of the buzz bombs, despite the fact that Lovett and others in the Air Force felt that that could be handled by fighters. The pilots didn't like it, because if they tried to shoot down a V-1, they had to fly through the rubbish and get blown up by the explosives on the little toy airplane. So they played no part whatsoever in handling the V-1 crisis. But it was all done with radar ground control and proximity fuses. Now here, they don't realize, putting it egotistically, that I was the one who handled that problem completely. But otherwise, they got into Arnold's papers and as I've read this, Frank must have got panicky or somebody sent a message to him, because the story is that he and Rowan Gaither, a brilliant lawyer out of the West Coast, G-A-I-T-H-E-R, who had been associated with the radiation lab, was called on by Frank, and the two of them, according to this book, visited Carl Compton. And about that time, although I wasn't following Rand by then, they now built up a staff of some of the brilliant minds that had been serving the military as what are called operational analysts. And they brought in some rather important brains, mathematical in nature. And it was then that Rand began to be built up. And that's after my time. The last connection I had with Rand was when Raymond Goldbaum and I went to see Arnold at Hamilton Field. To talk about the project. Arnold, to the best of my recollection, had retired for some time. And this airplane, by the way, Douglas was constructing for MacArthur's use. In other words, the project must have been begun before, some years before, because the airplane was flight tested, and we were the ones, I guess, who had the privilege of riding in it. And I, as an aside, as you may or may not know, MacArthur, everywhere he set up headquarters, he had a walking gallery. I lived in a couple of those places on my tours around the world. But that was his practice. And when it was in a civilian area, as it was in the Philippines, it was out where the people could look up and see him. He loved it. And this airplane had this walking gallery along the full length of the airplane, aside from the cockpit headquarters. So we enjoyed the ride and had a nice visit with Hap Arnold. And he seemed to be quite satisfied with what was going on. And that was when it was in Douglas's hands, before it was an independent organization. Now,
let me just insert here, Dr. Bowles. I have a copy of a memorandum relating to that meeting, and if it's the same one you're talking about, it took place in October of 1945.
The one in the Pentagon?
No, I'm sorry. This was for, you said, I thought you said the one at Hamilton Field.
Oh. Yes, what about it?
I thought that was the one you were referring to just now. Am I incorrect?
No, you're correct. Now, I don't know, is that somebody, my memorandum?
No, this is something that Arthur Raymond prepared.
Oh, good.
Why don't we pause here to turn the tape over?